You are tuned into Pentimental with hosts John and Tom McGuire. Pentimental is a dialogue-based show that elucidates the intersections between synchronicity, science, culture, and psychonautics. Through the medium of open-minded dialogue, we explore the possibility that the only way out is in. www.thesyncbook.com/radio.
This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on Syncbook Radio. Today, episode number 2, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, Marty Leeds from Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour on Syncbook Radio, as well as a trialogue with Thomas Joseph Brown, former director of Borderlands Research Institute and former guest of Always Record, episode number 92. So it was a real pleasure this week to have each of these guests on. Again, my aim for the show is to bring on folks that I find have some kind of connection to one another, whether loose or explicit. I see something in their work that connects them in some way. This week, I hope the scientific and mathematical approaches found some kind of resonance with each other. I'm kind of hoping that's how each show might play out. I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much for tuning in.
So we just did the 100th episode of Always Record, and at one point in the episode, Alan had mentioned it prior to me off air, but he brought it up again that you see these twos popping up on Syncbook, both on Syncbook Press and on Syncbook Radio. So like your show and Synchronize, yours is white and orange and Synchronize is orange and white, and they both have references to an hour, one symbolically and one written out. And then Pentimental, which is my new one, and then Ezra's new one, they both use a pentagram. And then 42 Minutes and Always Record has kind of like the two play buttons. And then if you go to the books, you see actually twos again, two trees, two skies, and two red ones with a snake. And it's just that theme has been coming up for me, I guess, the past like week and a half in this twin prime idea, which I think you're somewhat familiar with. And I'd be interested to know more what your thoughts are on that and kind of maybe if it has any links to these kind of twin synchronicities, or what's the intersection between those, if anything. Obviously, there's some kind of feedback set up between the creations, the creators, and so on.
Yeah, actually more of a very interwoven and tight association between them. I mean, I think that the idea of a unity of opposites, right? This, you know, just the idea of twins in and of itself, the yin and the yang kind of thing, Boasian, and that is a fundamental archetype of our creation, I think. So that is prevalent all over. Happening around us, that's happening psychologically, you know, within us, that's, you know, within without, that sort of thing. And synchronicities happen all the time, of course. I mean, this whole network is built on this idea that we find this stuff everywhere. So I think that when, and I think the person that posted was Misty Greer, right? Yeah. And she was saying, well, I mean, just when you, I think when you have more artistically minded people, people that are, I would say, that are cutting through the thin veneer of reality, if you will, they can pull that stuff out more. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
A one-off phenomenon, like this person notices it here. I think it's happening all the time all around us. And it's only people that have like attuned their consciousness, if you will, to actually recognize this stuff. You know, and I think we were having this conversation, I forget who it was, maybe Will Morgan and I were having this conversation at the Sync Summit about this idea that it seems that people that are more artistically minded, people that go into the actual creative aspects of creation and see how playful it is, are able to, you know, like I said, attenuate this stuff, recognize this stuff more, and then pull it out and actually say, look at this. Isn't this interesting? So, I mean, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the best way I can kind of understand it anyway. And what twin primes are just primes that are next to each other in the number line, to explain that. So, for instance, and using gematria, the one that I like to point out is twin TWIN is 7451. This is, what is that? Is that 19? No, that's 17. And then prime is 19. So twin equals 17, prime equals 19. Well, twin primes, a twin prime is 17 and 19 because they're right next to each other in the number line. They're only one number apart. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea. So twin prime actually is a twin prime. So just to clarify that.
Okay, that's cool.
Did that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And you know, what's resonating with me there is this idea of like teasing stuff out between this kind of interface between whatever we, our day-to-day reality is, and then wherever synchronicity comes and these other kinds of meaningful occurrences come out of. And it seems that nature always creates in pairs, right? So this twin idea, cause and effect, there's always an electron for a positron and vice versa. But somehow, if that was necessarily the case, one would think that everything would be annihilated, because when an electron and a positron get close to each other, they annihilate and it's nothing but light. But also light can transform back into particles. So there's this, always this dance going on between two. And then that those dyads kind of join up into other kind of this meshwork of networks and social connections that then create this larger consciousness structure, or at least they're almost like a giant conduit for it, or an electrical circuit or something like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, even annihilation and creation are, you know, twins, if you will.
Yeah. Two sides of the same coin, right? You can't exactly have creation without tearing something down. So it's a primordial chaos idea of, yeah, creation through destruction and vice versa. And that they are, everything's a dynamic process, nothing's static. So dynamics means change. And change sometimes looks violent, but at the same time, some of the most beautiful things are change. Birth. I like that McKenna reference. He says that birth looks so horrifying to, say, an alien eye seeing that. But at the same time, it's also giving life to something. So it's under, yeah, looking below the surface, I guess.
Yeah. Isn't like one of his talks, he talks about like if you like came, you walked around the corner and somebody was given birth, you would be like, oh, I need to, this person needs medical attention right away. And yet it's this beautiful process of bringing life into the world. You know, I mean, even chaos, even the idea of chaos and order, like you kind of hit on the, these are once again twins, even chaos and order, chaos is only perceived chaos. You know, it's only, it's really order at a different level, meaning that if like, you know, even the process of resituating whatever kind of concept you're talking about, when things are getting resituated, like let's say you're in a classroom, right? And it's a bunch of kids, kindergarten classroom. The teacher's like, all right, everybody get to your desk. And all of a sudden you see everybody just scrambling around. You know what I mean? And it looks like chaos. You know, if you would just jumped into that room, you'd be like, oh, this room is in chaos. And yet that's just the moving towards order, if you will.
Are you familiar with broken symmetry, that concept?
No. What is this?
When symmetry gets rearranged, the symmetry becomes quote unquote broken. Okay. So there's asymmetrical pairings of numbers. There's asymmetrical byproducts. So it looks disordered, but there's actually a very coherent hidden symmetry to it, but it almost looks asymmetrical. It's this idea of, I guess, Platonic reality versus reality that we see around us. Reality we see around us is kind of fuzzy. There are no natural right angles, or at least that's what I've heard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we're trying to mimic this perfect Platonic reality, supposedly. And so this kind of goes hand in hand with those ideas, I think, where we have chaos all around us, which is, again, this rough around the edges process. And is that the primordial thing, or do we have the Platonic reality as the primordial thing? I mean, are we... is there such thing as the Platonic reality, or is it nothing but chaos and that 50-50 split between light and dark, I guess?
No, I think, you know, it's like you have the idea of the ideal and the real, you know, where the Platonic reality would be the ideal. And then, of course, you have our reality as the reality, as if the Platonics, you know, the Platonic idea would be like the template for reality, that reality is always moving towards in this ever moving chaos of order, if you will, you know, always moving towards that, but never really reaching it. And then, and that not reaching it would be our reality, you know? And so, I think, you know, when you look at all of the, like, you know, geometricians of the past or whatever, whenever they were trying to create some sort of architecture or painting, whatever like that, is like, they were always trying to push towards that ideal, knowing that they're living in, you know, the reality of it. If that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so it's once again, it's like the twins, they both exist. Underpinning our entire reality is, I would say, this perfect matrix of, well, geometry, you know, if you're just going to get right down to it. But of course, in the movement of our reality, what we get is, well, like you were saying, the fuzzy lines, the perceived chaos.
Sure. It's, yeah, it is that movement. And I always go back and forth between what's primordial. Is it the process itself that creates the shape, or is it the flow itself that's trying to mimic the static shape? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's this almost dynamism, or this kind of antagonism between, say, something like Newtonian absolute space and Einstein's relativistic space. So you have they're both, yes, deterministic, but at the same time, the Einsteinian manifold takes on a whole kind of new character that is more flexible and has more degrees of freedom and isn't so much the thing that everything takes place in as much as a dynamic partner in it. And I like that idea as far as like synchronicity goes and kind of like our interaction with it. And I don't know, that's how I model the Platonic reality or whatever. I see it as a movement more than rigid structure or geometry. And so I'm not saying what you're saying is wrong at all, and I'm not disagreeing. But it's like this, it's a different way of seeing the same thing almost.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about a primordial anything, beginning, right? Well, I mean, prime means first, and ordeal means order. So there's a first order. I think it was Kepler that said, what's that quote? Geometry existed before the creation. It is co-eternal with the mind of God. Saying in like the first instance of creation, there was an order that was put forward, you know? It's almost like and allowed the parameters of the universe to flesh out all the way up to beings like ourselves. Almost like if you're going to play a guitar, you have those six strings. They're there. They're always going to be there. You have 24 frets, six strings. That's what you got to work with. The conscious being plays the song, but it's always going to have those parameters there. It's always going to have that first order there that it's going to rely on, that being the Platonic reality, or if you know what I'm saying, the Platonic underpinning of everything.
Yes, I understand that completely. And this idea is the universe is more a musical instrument or a giant soundboard versus this giant computer. You know, I like the musical instrument analogy, to be perfectly honest. And if I had to adopt one, and if you really look at the science, it's not a horrible analogy at all. In fact, it's quite accurate.
Well, that's the Platonic music, sure, of the spheres, you know.
Yeah.
I'm saying nothing original here whatsoever. You know, I mean, that's basically what they're saying, is that, you know, planets were chiming to each other and rotate, you know, in these fixed orbits and chiming with each other like this grand song, and us being the notes within the song, maybe.
Sure. And can't we maybe see a lot of what ritual has been throughout the ages, has been kind of striving towards reaching union with that, right? And then we call it God, or we call it whatever. But it's just, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's nature, and you can attach all kinds of names to it, and it's the universe, and you can attach all kinds of names to it. But it's just this thing. It's this process that seems to be striving towards higher complexity. Like you said, chaos is not really that. It's a misnomer. And it's really ordered complexity, but with all this dynamic movement that makes it confusing as hell to look at, right? So that's why the human experience is so difficult, because there's so much information flow and so little ability to filter it all. And so, yeah, seeing that, finding that union above and below, and the mathematical ritual and even the scientific ritual, I see as an extension of something very indigenous, primordial, only more westernized and turned into kind of there's a reductionist slant to it. But at the same time, it's also a way of knowing that I respect. And maybe, how did you get into it, I guess? And like, how do you see it? Do you see it as that? Do you have a different take on it, or what?
You know, it's really hard to say, because I got into doing this for so many different reasons, like, you know, personal trauma, wanting an answer, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Wondering about the nature of God, you spending a whole bunch of time in nature itself, whether that's camping, hiking, biking, whatever, and just, you know, being immersed in all of this stuff. And well, I mean, I think quantum physics has done a lot for really kind of poking and prodding people's philosophy to try to figure out what's going on, because, you know, we get presented with, you know, the other side of the Newtonian physics, this quantum world, and it doesn't make any sense. You know, our world seems to make sense, yet everything underneath doesn't make sense. Well, there has to be, well, here's that twin prime again, or that twin pair. There has to be a relationship between those two. And I think that the relationship between those two actually plays out in the human experience, the human condition, ultimately. And that goes so far as to say things like bringing in aspects of science that are pretty much completely refuted. Things like numerology, things like synchronicity, things like intention, that those sorts of things. These are things that are completely shunned by modern academia. And yet, when we look at all of these independent people, such as yourself, such as myself, the community that we're involved in, they're really bringing this stuff out to say that to deny this stuff is just asinine. To just say this is all just kind of like made up, or we're just, over imaginative people, I think is just insane.
Right. And I remember talking to David Plait a little while ago, and LSD came up, and he mentioned that by going as far into the material, we came back with this kind of like spiritual technology, or by going as far into that realm, you still come out with some kind of spiritual perspective. And honestly, I see that in the mainstream science community, but they're not spiritual at all. But when you look at the mythology that's been created, it is very Platonic. It is very Judeo-Christian. It has all these iterations of the past and all this history and baggage associated with it that everyone's in denial about, really.
You mean like the dogma and indoctrination of modern science? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that by going so far in that direction, they still come to – it's almost like the human experience and these kind of archetypes are almost inescapable no matter which way you go. And I'm not – and while, yes, what they say is hardening into dogma, it's interesting that a lot of what they come back to has so much in common with past stories and mythologies and – other ways of seeing the world and engaging with the world and, I guess, quote-unquote, interrogating nature. So magic ritual is one way of interrogating nature, and scientific ritual is one way of doing that. So scientific ritual has been elevated to kind of a new religion, maybe. But there's also another layer to it, kind of like, again, what we're engaging with, especially what you're engaging with. You have a good understanding of the technical side, which, honestly, I don't. I'm kind of a generalist, and I'm a synthesizer, and I'm just never been a numbers guy. Anyway, I don't know where I'm going with that, but
it doesn't mean not all who wander are lost, right?
Right. It's all good. But I guess, like, since we're on maybe the Judeo-Christian angle, one of your more recent videos was the monogram of Christ, right? So what exactly were you like trying to communicate in that video, and what you're getting at there and what it means to you?
Well, the one thing that I found investigating this stuff heavily for like many years now is that there seemed to be that's even ridiculous to say that. To me, there absolutely is a story. There's a message. There's something to be said. All of this stuff, the geometry, the numbers, the mythologies, the letters and the numbers attached to those letters that are being concretized in and canonized in, like you were saying, Judeo-Christian, whatever really religion it is, because Kabbalism is not just, Judeo-Christian or anything like that, or English, of course, it's Greek and Aramaic and et cetera. There's a message behind all of this stuff. There's a message in the numbers. They're telling a story. That these things are alive. These are principles of reality that are real. Numbers are real. And so whenever I investigate this stuff, the one thing that I refuse to do is try to place my own opinions on these things, or try to, place a theory onto these things. What I'm trying to do is extract and deduce directly from, the concept, the idea, whatever it is, the phenomenon, what it's trying to say. And I that's how I lead all of my investigations. You get too much bias into it. Laird Scranton, I just had Laird Scranton on the show. He's written a bunch of really great books. One of the things he was talking about is in his own investigative process is the fact that, the challenge is that people can be so wishful. They want things to connect, even though they might not connect, And so I wanted to just, extract that out, take that out completely. And I was just like going to go in and say, okay, well, what does the number one have to say? What is it saying? What does it mean philosophically? What does it mean mathematically? What does it mean geometrically? That sort of thing. And so any of the stuff that I go into, that's what I'm trying to do is like, okay, if there is a message there, if these people of the past canonize this stuff for people in the future, and there is a message, well, that message should be universal. It should be timeless, right? It should always be there. And so that's what I'm trying to do. That's what I'm trying to do with all this stuff. Now, like the monogram of Christ, one of the things that I found so interesting, and this is something that I had noticed, is that how many pictures will you see where Jesus Christ is clearly counting on his fingers? And I showed in that video, there's probably four or five images that I had just pulled out just randomly from the internet of looking at this. It's like, okay, well, you know, your hand, if that's built by God or the universe or nature, whatever it is, you're saying, well, that's not Judeo-Christian. That's not, you know, just attributed to Jesus Christ. That's every single person that's ever lived. You know what I mean? So therefore, if these ancient religions were trying to, you know, trying to bring to earth, to surface this ancient knowledge, well, it would be timeless knowledge and it would be able to be found at any time, any day. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what period, what culture you lived in. If you believed in Allah or Amu or Jah or Ra, it doesn't matter what it is. It's going to be within every single human being. And that's that universality, that ubiquitousness or that homogenous aspect of this is what is just so fucking appealing to me. Because it just means that anybody that tries to create a division with this stuff is missing the point completely. The illusion of fragmentation is – hold on. I have this quote here. This is the illusion of fragmentation is the great trickery posed upon man in his quest to find wholeness. Without the delusion of division, we could never experience every subtle nuance of the universe's fullness. Without the appearance of division, we could not make the journey to put the puzzling pieces of this life back together.
That sounds just like I'm like David Bohm's biggest cheerleader, but I hear him reverberated in so many people's works that I bring him up often. And, you know, one of his books was titled Wholeness in the Implicate Order. And there's this.
It's a fantastic book.
And I've actually tried to tackle The Undivided Universe, which was quite a challenge because I'm not trained as a scientist and it's full of equations, you know, but it was cool and it's a trip. And I recommend anyone that's like trying to learn this stuff, just jump head first in anything that's difficult. I think that's one of the most fun ways of going about it and in most rewarding ways. If your brain works that way, some of us work good from little bits and work up, but some of us work good at just kind of like going into the big picture and kind of getting a feel for what it's all about. And I think even with something as obscure as mathematics, while obscure in most people's minds, there's two different approaches to it, right? And so that's why I see there's kind of like the linear approach and the nonlinear approach. And I always see synchronicity as kind of like the nonlinear, playful trickster side to the mathematics. And then maybe, you know, the linear equations, that Newtonian paradigm is kind of like the stricter, you know, negative feedback kind of dynamic. And I don't know. I just see that I see these things as larger pictures. You're talking about universalities and all these common things in the human mind. And I just see permutations of similar themes over and over. And I love seeing it in science. And that was kind of a byproduct of me studying it as I saw the same kinds of stuff.
Well, you know, getting back to this theme, math is the perfect way to express that there is a linear and there is an imaginative and creative side to our universe. And there's also this parameters of hard scientific laws. Meaning that when you look at mathematics, you can calculate stuff. You can calculate how many eggs you have in a carton. You can triangulate something and get the exact measurement, that sort of thing. But then there's also this playful side of it where it's like, okay, now we can look at the 14 phalanges on our fingers and count 1 + 4 and find that we have 5 appendages on our hand. There's nothing quantitative about that. And yet actually it is, but it's playful. It's trickery. And we can see that both of these are absolutely verifiable. So math is this beautiful way. And pi really kind of shows this when you were saying linear, you know, cyclical. Well, that's exactly what pi is. It's a line and then a circle. So it's obviously, if this is one of the most, you know, fundamental constants and mathematical constants in creation, well, just in once again, going right to the symbol itself, going right to the geometry itself. I'm not going to tell you what pi means. Pi is telling us what it means. There's a cyclical aspect and there's a linear aspect of our creation. It's only the merging of the two where you get the infinite.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that brings me to this point of zero and infinity, which is another thing that's kept popping up for me. And I guess, you know, you have zero, which is the nothing, and then infinity, which is the everything. But an infinity is really just two zeros united. So the line between what is nothing and what is everything becomes kind of blurry in that relationship. Or I guess, what do you see their roles as in the pantheon of mathematics? And how do you see their relationship with one another, if significant?
Infinity and nothingness?
Yeah, zero and infinity.
Yeah. You know, going back to this conversation I had with Laird Scranton, this is something that he was really talking about, that a lot of these ancient cultures, I think he was speaking about the Chinese at the time and the Dogon, the Buddhists believe kind of the same thing. Really kind of almost getting into relativity in a way. When you get, when you take matter to a certain speed, it basically goes out of time, right? So you take it as fast as you can possibly get. And eventually what you're going to do is push that out of time, right? when you slow it down and it becomes more material, if you will, it gets lost into the infinite, infinity. But infinity is a cycle. That's what that's what the infinity sign is actually showing you. If you, and actually just, you can do this. And I think I showed this in one of the videos or in one of the books or something like that. But if you take your pen and you put it on a piece of paper and draw the infinity sign, what you're going to have is one movement and one point. So you're going to put your pen down. You're going to go out. You're going to go out. You're going to go out and you're going to circle in and you're going to circle in and then you're going to cross a point and then you're going to go in and then ultimately you're coming out in. It's one universal movement. So infinity, even though we think that infinity is this constant movement throughout time, you can't possibly measure linear infinity. What the infinity sign is actually saying is that infinity is wrapped up within itself. But why is it wrapped up within itself? Because it really gets to the holographic universe kind of thing, that we're creating that through our own consciousness, that our out is the in. Now, we're in the material dimension, so we can't possibly know what it's like to be nothing. You know, we would have to therefore, disperse all of our materiality, go outside of the dimension of time. And what happens if you have that dimension of time? You go outside of the dimension of time. Well, you would get into the nothing, the nothingness. And that's the first number or non-number in our number line. Right. So that basically that's the kind of idea, is that we have the two interplay. We have the all time and all space all at once being the nothingness. And then you have the material dimension. And then the conversation that we were having, I thought it was so fucking interesting, is that basically when you realize that, you can kind of imagine this, that in the beginning, the great creator being, this great intelligent force, was nothingness. It was nothingness. It was those primeval waters, if you will, of the no thing. And that always existed. It was always beyond time. The great creator didn't have an end. It didn't have a beginning. It was just always there. But then it actually gave forth, God said, let there be light kind of thing, the material dimension. And that material dimension we see as infinity. And this is why you have so many of these ancient cultures talk about the fact that there was a beginning. Though philosophically, if there is a God that's omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, there shouldn't be a beginning, because that God should have existed forever, right? So we have a paradox. But if you understand the ideas of terrestrial, celestial, if you will, or spirit and matter, you bring those into science, then all of a sudden you have that paradox solved. And you have it solved through what the Buddha are saying, what the Buddhists are saying, what the Dogon are saying, what the Chinese are saying, what the Hindus are saying, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's this really beautiful merging that happens with modern science.
Oh, absolutely. And again, just to rehash kind of what modern science has to say, they say it all starts with the primordial ocean of the Higgs field, and the Higgs field breaks its symmetry. And from there you get a little bubble, and that bubble inflates, and then you get a universe like ours with planets and all this stuff. And so it's the exact same story in a mechanized package that has no real significance beyond the illusions we create in our own brains, right? So that's kind of like the modern theory of neuroscience and how we're supposed to view reality. So you say that numbers have a reality to them, and to an extent, I certainly agree. I see it as one of the more perfect languages that exists, but a language I always see is somewhat limited, there's that idea that, at least I know of it from Islam, that you can't really portray God in image. To portray something divine is almost impossible, right? So even with number, I see it as it's such a great tool, right? And you use it so beautifully, handle it like an instrument, but it's almost like there's limits to everything. Is that right or wrong?
Well, this is what's so beautiful about numbers and geometry, is that they're, as far as I've understood, is that they're archetypes of the mind. So when you say, when people say whatever, it's like, don't put, you can make no image of God, or thou cannot speak God's name. Well, basically what you have is a deep metaphysical, mystical truth underneath that, is basically saying, well, why can't you? Well, because we have to equate God to something. Well, what are we going to equate God to something? What are we going to equate God to? Well, if mathematics is this language of creation, according to Galileo and Pythagoras and Socrates, not Marty Leeds, according to these heavyweights of, intellectual heavyweights, then if we're going to equate God to something that is in the material dimension, well, the only thing that we could equate it to would be the zero, because the zero is something that denotes nothingness, nothingness, immateriality. And yet it has a symbol. It has a word to it, and yet it's denoting something that's beyond the material. So there's, there's a deep, metaphysical truth there. And the other thing that's so interesting about the zero is that You know, the zero, at least in English and in, you know, several other languages, is basically a circle. It's either ovular or it's a circle, right? Well, the circle, as we know, encapsulates the most amount of space, you know, in two dimensions geometrically. And the circle also, in order to measure that circle, we also have to use pi. So we have this idea of pi being an infinite number. So we have the infinite in there. And then we also have geometrically it encapsulating the most amount of space. So we have the infinite. So we have this idea of the zero or nothingness. And what is it doing? Well, it's encapsulating infinity by the straight math and geometry. Once again, I'm not placing these ideas onto this. This is just how it works. Now, when we look at this and you know, equate this with how we think, we can start to understand, at least this is how I've come to understand it, that we can equate spiritual concepts directly with math, because the spiritual concepts are inherent in the math. The beautiful thing about this is that I'm kind of a dummy. Like, I'm not that smart of a guy. And what the one thing that I found that was so just overtly true about all this stuff is that there's a simplicity to all this. And even Da Vinci said, simplicity is the highest form of sophistication. And that's actually what you find in the numbers. So when, you know, we were talking earlier about David Bohm, you know, he has this big book on math and things like that. And it seems like, oh, you can't even, it's just something you could never surmount. Yet at the same time, if we talked about the fundamental ideas of what he's talking about in just philosophy and number philosophy, we wouldn't have to go past two, the number two, like literally to really hone in what he's saying. You know, we could just start with zero, one, two, and just look at the philosophy, look what those numbers mean, look at the geometry, and we could get a lot of places before we ever get into the complex quantitative mathematics side, if you know what I'm saying.
There is a simplicity to things, and there is honestly like kind of a straightforward truth to a lot of subjects. Now, there is a lot of complexity and a lot of beautiful complexity, but again, getting to chaos again, there's always some simplicity in the infinitely complex, and there's something infinitely complex in the extremely simple. So there's always this complex and this duality coming on. And what that shows us is it's within anyone's grasp to kind of become intuited with whatever we consider nature to be. And there's many ways to do that, right? Like, so you do it through mathematics. Other people might do it through poetry. I see it all as kind of art and a pursuit of knowing the zero or the infinity or the both, that union, trying to meet up with it in some way or have it manifest, you know, and just kind of wink at you.
Yeah, I've been kind of thinking lately that I don't know if it can be done. God, I might be eating my words here. I don't know if it can be done without math, though. Meaning that for years, I pursued all the arts. You know what I mean? Like I wrote poetry and I wrote songs. I had written a short screenplay. You know, I'd read a lot. You know, I'd hiked. I mean, you know, I have lived a pretty full life. You know, I've done lots of different things. But it was only when I got to the math that all of this stuff started making sense to me, and making sense intuitively. Things that it was like, well, Jesus, you come across an idea and it's so solid fucking gold that it's like now those ideas have stuck with me. And it was only when I brought the mathematics and geometry to it. Now, that's just my opinion, right? That's just my own personal foray into this. But when you look back in history and you look at all of the archaeological sites, all the Gothic cathedrals, the temples, they're all saying the same thing. They're all canonizing this stuff in geometry because they're saying, if we want to open that door and we want to go in and we want to discover that divine, then this is what you have to do. I think even Michael Mayer, who is an alchemist, I think 1600, something like that, said, you cannot find the philosopher's stone without this geometric teaching. And the more and more I work with this, I realize that if we are going to speak the language of God, the universe, nature, whatever it is you'd like to call it, and then we have to speak its language, period. You know, otherwise we're just going to be dancing around the center of that circle. And we want to get to the center of that circle.
Right.
We want to find that.
And, you know, personally speaking, again, I'm incompetent with the actual practical application of the math, but at the same time, it is something I could learn. I realize that, but you know, I've studied math just kind of on an intellectual kind of the philosophy of mathematics and what are some of the larger questions about it. And it's not quote unquote my thing, but at the same time, it's helped. It's provided a feedback between other subjects also that I pursue, and it creates this interesting synthesis and really makes your perspective more dynamic. Isn't that what it's all about? Isn't that what experience is about? Is always learning something new and being able to see the world with new eyes. So whatever helps you readjust your lens or to make it sharper, is good. And so you, for example, Marty, you have done almost everything by the sounds of it in terms of pursuing the creative side of yourself. And that's like part of it, right? It's marrying all those, what we would say, oh, that's contradictory in ourselves. But in fact, they go hand in hand if you're willing to embrace them all.
Yeah. And this creative side of the math, I think, is so important too, because how many people go into mathematics and yet it's only the quantitative side. And so they never discover exactly any of this stuff. And in fact, so much so that they completely disregard it or call guys like me kooks and cranks and charlatans and whatever, you know, or guys like Randy Powell, the same kind of thing, you know? And that's just a fucking shame to me, because it's like, man, you're missing out so much. You know, there's just so much that you could just sink your teeth into, and yet you're just completely denying it. You know?
Yeah. It's, you know, it's like this word is overused, but it's this kind of fascist strain of psychology that, you know, insists on one right way, and then all the other ways that are quote unquote competing with it must be shut down, because why? Everyone's competing for dollars and cents, and there's all this sorts of, you know, power games associated with that. So the pursuit of knowledge gets kind of shortchanged in all of that nonsense, I would say. And that's the unfortunate sign. You see that manifested in all kinds of areas of society. So science, religion, politics, et cetera, et cetera. And something like SyncBook or like your work and synchronicity generally, it's a way to kind of break open the head a bit and to break away from black and white thinking, because it isn't black and white, even though there's some things that are, most of it isn't, at least in my opinion.
Yeah. And I think the sync community, I think, could do a lot more if there was more math involved, I think, because did you see Joe Alexander's thing on Back to the Future, the 9/11
yes.
one? Yeah. So I don't know a lot of his videos. So I caught that one and then a couple other ones with Back to the Future. But I noticed in the Back to the Future, right? So they go to 88, right? He, you know, and then he goes back and they look at the clock and it's 9/11, and then he, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all these numbers that are attached to it. Well, I noticed that when he was going to the Twin Pines Mall, it goes Twin Pines and then Lone Pine, right? That's when he goes back to the future. Anyway, so, but on the clock, or on the clock, when he pulls up to the Twin Pines, it's 1:16, right? 1:16. Then when he pulls up again and there's a Lone Pine, it's the numbers 1:33. So in the movie, once again, crazy synchronicity that no one would recognize basically except me, because I'm really the only guy that works with this shit. But I noticed 1:16 and 1:33. Well, those two numbers mean a whole shitload. You know, 1:16 in English gematria is 360 degrees. That's what 360 degrees equals, 1:16. Up, down, left, right, forward, and reverse, you know, the six directions of space equals 1:33. So basically you have this whole geometric understanding of a philosophical understanding of man's place being the 360 degrees of a circle, if you will, and, you know, the six directions of space resting on the seventh in those two numbers in the movie. And, you know, yet no one really, I mean, I'm just bringing this up right now. I'm sure no one's made that correlation, yet it's right there. And so you start to realize that when you bring the numeric aspect into it, there's so much more that we can extract from it. And I think that's why maybe I was so drawn to the sync community in a way, because everyone's just so fucking smart. You know, everyone sees these things and can bring them together in this just crazy mythological way. And yet when you look at the mythologies and you look at, you know, a mystical understanding, it's just steeped in number, all of it. You know, whether we go to you know, the Bible or the Sefer Yetzirah, or we go to Aleister Crowley or whatever, you know, numeric study is just so uber important. And I think we can start to understand these synchronicities, the playfulness of the creation a little bit better, or much better, if we brought the numeric side into it. I guess it's just all I want to say.
Let me pose this question to you, just to kind of be devil's advocate a little bit. How have you reconciled statistics with synchronicity? So the hardcore statistician will say, well, anything that can happen does, and that explains synchronicity. So how do you confront that if someone would bring that to your attention, maybe?
You know, I guess we'd have to look at like a particular example. Well, I mean, let's look at the example of 9/11. Like, how many movies and things like that, whether it's with The Matrix had 9/11 in it and his what ID, you know, we look at the clock and Back to the Future has 9/11. Out of all the times that, you know, 9/11 shows up, I mean, I suppose statistically all these other numbers show up as well, right? But then you have this idea that 9/11 is a significant number. So when you see it happening prior to an event, it's like the idea of just completely denying that is asinine. Scott does a really good job with this. Scott Onstott does a really good job with this in one of his books. I think it's in Secrets in Plain Sight too. Yeah, I think it's in that one. Anyway, he shows all these clocks, right? All these watches, and they're all at 10:08. Like all of them. He's just got a whole list of them. And it's like, okay, are you really going to present that to a statistician and say, look, this is all just a coincidence? What was of that? You know, and then we could go and say, oh, well, watch companies did that because it's the best way to show the clock or whatever. It's like, okay, well, that's sure. You could say that, but every single one of them, like, I mean, literally, if you go and just put in watch in a search engine right now, right? Or put in clock or whatever, and just look, those clocks are going to be turned to 10:08. Is that, what is that phenomenon? Is that a synchronicity? Is that planned? Is that, you know what I mean? And I don't know if I'm answering this question well enough, because statistics can always be manipulated, right?
Yes.
I mean, even if we were on the sync side of it, we could say, oh, well, we're just going to manipulate all the statistics, say, look at all these things that equal 9/11.
And that's the whole, you know, not to interrupt you, but that's kind of like the whole issue in the, say, the Psi community, where we're trying to accumulate, I'm an observer, but they're trying to accumulate enough statistical evidence to say, okay, this is a real phenomenon in micro kind of events while influencing random number generators, stuff like that. But at the same time, then they go back and forth, and one side says they have the statistics and show it's good, and the other side says, well, if we had tweaked this, then it's different. So like you said, just in that alone, I think we put so much emphasis on we're trying to attack these super complex, highly nonlinear phenomenon with, yes, like you've said, math can be used to tackle a lot of those problems. But sometimes in these kind of cases, I think it's almost like applying the wrong tools to the wrong situation.
This kind of gets away from synchronicity again, but since we're talking about kind of like modern science, it's like, what is the statistical possibility that this happened at all? In the beginning of time, with just the very first instance of the Big Bang, anything could have happened, right? You know, I mean, out of all the infinite possibilities of things that could have happened, that happened. So statistically, this shouldn't even be here. Just the first moment of creation, statistically, shouldn't have fucking happened. And yet it did. And every moment from then happened. And happened so well that they say Earth is in the Goldilocks zone. But that's bullshit, man. The whole universe is in the Goldilocks zone, you know? Yeah, it's like, I mean, these laws and these principles are at work and they never stop. It's like one gets a little fluky here, there. No, they're always there. So when modern science approaches the view, the philosophical view of reality and say, oh, there's no evidence for God, or there's no evidence for an intelligent force behind this thing, that to me is like, that's not even philosophy 101. You know, that's so crazy to me to even think that there's no evidence whatsoever. And I'm talking about guys like, you know, Daniel Dennett and, you know Richard Dawkins, these cats, right? Yeah. And that it's just like, okay, well, these are, once again, intellectual heavyweights, right, out there that are saying this stuff. And it's like, okay, well, to me, you're not even doing a little math. What is the statistical possibility that we would even still be here after, quote unquote, 13.75 billion years or whatever?
Sure. You add everything up. Yeah. It's so mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I'm just talking about the first moment of everything coming from nothing. What is the statistical possibility of that? Really, it shouldn't be. It just shouldn't be. It should have just pittered out and that's it. If we're just dealing with a mechanistic approach.
I guess let's go on one last path, shall we? So mathematics, generally, this kind of synthesis or this marriage of ritual, mathematics, mysticism, it's long, at least in the Western tradition, been kept in kind of like these mystery schools, whereas in other cultures, you see it shared more widely. I guess, what is your opinion on either or that kind of contrast between the two? Why kept secret in others and then it's just freely shared amongst other groups? And what do you think the purpose of all that was? And yeah, what do you think?
You know, it's a broad question because you can go so many different areas with this. Like, to look at the conspiracy side of it right away, why did these schools show up? Why Masonry? Why the Grecian schools? Why the Egyptian schools? You know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, why did they show up? Well, to obviously preserve this information that was being hijacked by an elite group of people. this goes right back to what we were saying before about the fact that it's like, you know, I've kind of come to this place where it's like, I don't think that you can get to a true understanding of the divine without speaking its language. Well, if you can convince an entire populace, or, you know, I mean, let's just say it brainwashed an entire populace not to study mathematics, well, then guess what you just did? You cut everybody off from the divine. And so, of course, what was going to happen? You're going to have people that recognize this, that recognize the, you know, subversive nature of the Vatican or whoever it was, the people in power, the Zionist, Illuminati, whatever the fuck you want to say it is, recognize this and had to keep this alive. And of course, they had to keep it alive cryptically, because if they didn't, it's like shining a light on the answers or whatever. It's going to get hijacked. It's going to get infiltrated again. And it's going to get destroyed. So this is why I think that there's so much of a cryptic and occult and mystical nature around this stuff. Not only is it mystical in and of itself, in the nature of it's mystical, but it had to be cryptic in order to keep it alive and pass through generation upon generation. Now, as far as the idea of it being prevalent, being shared, you know, throughout communities of the golden age cultures, well, I think ultimately that's what we're here to do, is find this information and share it with the world. I mean, keep referencing my podcast here, but I was talking to Crichton E. Miller, and I asked him, I was like, hey man, cause what Crichton Miller had done is basically rediscovered that the cross, that the Celtic cross and the cross itself were these navigational tools that you could use to find longitude and latitude and sail the seas and understand cyclical time and star, all of that shit. And I asked him, I was like, well, do you think that now is the time to bring this information out? And he just said point blank to me, that's what it's there for. That's why these people created these symbols or brought these symbols down from the heavens or whatever, you know, whatever terms you want to couch it in, is because eventually people were going to rediscover this and realize how truly sacred it was, how that just through simple symbols, through simple math, through simple geometry, you could connect to something higher than that was all around you, you know, that was synchronistically happening all around you. I mean, that's my best take on that, you know, the subversive angle of it, the occult angle, and then the, you know, the conceal and reveal, if you will.
Sure. And there's something very, I don't know, there is something very subversive and I guess magical about the idea of finding yourself. So we take that for granted, right? We grow up, we become men or women, and we go on with our lives, but at some point the exploration ends, or that's the way it seems to be. And so the pursuit of self stops. But all the mystery schools say that's all that there is. That's the only pursuit. But what do people pursue instead? They pursue power, prestige, egotistical kind of stuff. And again, no matter what you do, it's really about intention.
To kind of say this too, is personally, I feel like this should be taught. And I feel like at one point it was taught, like there was open schools that people could come. And it's like, it's still up to you. You still have the conscious free will to say, well, I don't really give a shit about learning about how I'm connected to the divine, you know, and you can drop out of school or not follow that. But I think that in places like Angkor Wat, you know, for instance, I think those are places that people went to learn this stuff because it was just taught freely and openly, because in my opinion, it should be. And I think that, you know, I think the people with higher ideals in the world, this is what they were doing. They were finding this stuff, teaching it and presenting it in any way they could. And that means through books, that means through lectures, all the temples, cathedrals, tabernacles, all of that stuff. And I think it's insanely important in our current time. I mean, I think it's insanely important that we open the occult book of knowledge and bring this wisdom out, because I think it just clarifies so much. It's clarified so much for me. I mean, so much so that, I mean, if you ask me if 6 years or 7 years ago or whatever, if I believed in a deity, a divine God or whatever, I'd have been like, oh, I don't know. But now it's just like, of course, you know, of course I do, you know, and I recognize it every single day of my life now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, everyone comes to experience whatever it is in their own way. And it is just about the pursuit more so than we all walk different paths towards it. But that is what synchronicity reveals, right? It's the ultimate unique psychedelic experience for each person if you choose to pursue it. And so it's going to guide you personally in different directions.
Oh, I was just going to say that this kind of goes back to, you know, what we were talking about before about creative people finding synchronicities in the world. I think you have to develop your consciousness so much to really get this. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you have to have gone so far along on your own path to really start seeing these things everywhere. And that's why I said before, when, you know, when I, why, one of the reasons why I joined the Syncbook Radio and things like that is because all these people are just, they're on a path and they're really fucking smart, you know, and they're seeking out something, and you can tell that they're on their path. And that's why they're noticing that stuff. And that's why I would say, in one respect, why the Syncbook community isn't bigger than it is because there's not a lot of people on this path. There's a lot of people that claim that they're on the path. There's a lot of people that, you know, seek out occult wisdom or look at the Illuminati or whatever, that think that they're doing this work, if you will. But I don't really think they are. That might be a little boastful statement, so I apologize about that. But do you know what I'm getting at there?
Look, there are superficial pursuits of everything in all schools of thought and all forms of scholarship. And so it's not criticizing, you know, the community. It's criticizing, hey, there's different brands of all kinds of pursuits. And it's like, hey, what do we stand by and what don't we stand by? And that's part of being a person. I wouldn't take offense, you know, if like I'm on the other side. It's like, hey, we all see things differently sometimes. And that's also the beauty of it too, getting through those differences. And sometimes they are seemingly irreconcilable, but in a lot of ways, sometimes they're not. And in pursuing these things, I feel like doors open and opportunities open between people, and also just in our own minds, you know, about what's possible and for our own lives and so on and so forth, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. You know, I mean, just getting back to thinking about Joe Alexander again, I mean, he's a basketball player, right? You know, how many basketball players are just looking at chasing some tail, or, you know, smoking some weed after the game, or making a lot of money, or getting famous, or driving a big fast fucking car, or whatever it is. Yet here's a guy that's in that same realm that is on a path. You know what I mean? He's seeking things out in the world. He's trying to make sense of the world. And when you're on that path so long, then look what it can bring you. You know, I mean, I think everything that I've seen with his videos thus far is really kind of genius, you know? And I think that says a lot about the acceleration of your consciousness, you know, and what this path really is.
Yeah.
You know, and some people call it a spiritual path. Some people just call it whatever, the hike up the holy mountain. Whatever it is, like you could couch it in a ton of different terms, but it's all the same thing.
Sure. And I don't know. I see like at least in our own, all of in our own ways, some kind of usually, yeah, a lot of pain, but like most therapy with pain comes some kind of resolution. Not all the time, but it all depends on how it's approached, right? So you can't have healing without some kind of like discomfort. And it's part of that. It's like confronting that those darker parts of yourself and that kind of thing. And, it's also about like patience, right? Because people might jump into something like synchronicity and be like, oh, okay, now I'm paying attention. I'm not seeing anything. And what I'm seeing, it's random and that's not anything. But it's so much about intent, right? And it's just like, hey, do you feel like you want to learn something? Do you feel like you're in a rut and you want to break open your head? If your intent is to learn and to study and pursue that gnosis, that ascension through knowledge, then it'll come by itself. It's nothing that has to be pursued as much as it finds you, right? And often at kind of weird and unexpected times. But that's what's fun about it too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, as you were saying, presents itself all the time. And it's only the people with intent that will follow those leads, will fan the spark
right,
to make it a
flame. And it's about knowing how to read the book. It's like we're reading the book and it's understanding the language, and it's all part of that. And math is a big part of it, and other types of philosophical work and mythological studies play into that. And it's all just this intersection. It's a new kind of breed of the mystery schools, you know, and it is an exciting thing. And I'm glad to be part of it, quite frankly.
Yeah, and let me just say this, you know, getting back to this idea of really how important math is and quintessential in this whole thing is, because when we look at, we were just saying, look at the word like mythology or philosophy. Well, mythology, you know, we all know what a myth is, but ology is the study of, or logic. Well, logic comes directly from mathematics. That's how something is logical. If you can verify it, then it's logical. So even in the concept like mythology, you're talking about math. Philosophy is the same thing. Phi, lasso, phi, phi, and phi is the golden mean. It's the golden proportion. So when we think about something philosophically, what the word is saying is that, well, you better have that fundamental base of math there, you know? So I guess this is what I mean when bringing the math and the numeric and the geometric studies to the forefront in a lot of these things, because I think it just helps pull all the pieces together.